Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling, Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a Millennium Grant from the Scarman Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, a trip to Stroud and the Stroudwater Textile Trust, the emerging industrial revolution that happened there, and Robin Mitchell. Also, Peter Berenius, an interesting name, but I interviewed him back in 1992 in the Ebble Valley near Salisbury, the real Peter Berenius, son of the Finnish ambassador to Nazi Germany, who was one of the people who persuaded Rudolf Hess to fly, that was Hitler's deputy, by the way, to fly to London, or to fly to Britain anyway. So Peter Berenius interviewed the son of Tancred Berenius back in 1992. Also, Susan Lindauer. Now, she was working for the CIA, friendly with Saddam and working with the Libyan government before the various invasions. They tried to lock her up. They tried to give her a chemical lobotomy, but she's back and talking about Charlottesville and the controversies in the US. Finally, a local branch of Falun Gong, Bristol, against organ harvesting, are worried about organ harvesting in China. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. I'll give you contact details at the end of the show.
I'm Jane Ford, and I'm standing here at Dunkirk Mill, and the water is running out from underneath the building, under our feet, and we're standing in front of one of the oldest parts of the mill. The date on the wall is 1798, and there's a very tall stone chimney rising up. The mill grew at different phases. A bit further along, we have another date stamp in the wall, which is 1855. And as more machinery was invented, then the mill grew in size, and spinning and weaving and the carding of the wool all happened in the mill. All the processes took place on the site here, right from the raw wool to the finished article that was then sent off to London to the tailors and so on to be made into very fine suiting and coats and so on.
Now, people might spot this if they're driving between Stroud and Nailsworth on the left-hand side, if they're going the other way, on the right-hand side, between Nailsworth and Stroud. Gigantic, great building. It's now been turned into flats, most of them pretty much luxury flats. But you've managed to, as the Stroudwater Textile Trust, keep a little museum at the bottom. I think you've done rather well there.
It was part of the planning agreement that the existing water wheel should be kept. And in fact, we've got two other water wheels further along. And in an agreement with Nailsworth Town Council, the Stroudwater Textile Trust were given the task of operating the little museum and putting in some of the machinery that we had already saved. Over 100 people would have been employed here, and in the early days, whole families would have been employed. In the report that was done on the state of the mills, the mill owner here said that no children under the age of 9 would be employed, and the discipline was mostly in the hands of the parents. If any child was misbehaving, then it was hauled up before its parents to deal with it.
Because we do hear, don't we, that very young children were employed in some mills, but yes. So they could run underneath the looms and do some actually rather dangerous work.
Yes, there are some accidents recorded which are quite gory, but they said that there were none under the age of 9. Of course, if you were a large child, you might have got away with being younger, but taller.
So what's your take on the decline? Because obviously Stroud is no longer the world centre for innovation in industrial, pre-industrial revolution, that kind of thing, or even for textiles anymore.
The Stroud mills, they did all the processes, and in a way they perpetuated the craft idea that you went from the raw material to the finished article in one place with your name on the cloth. In the north, they tended to then specialise. So you had spinning mills or weaving mills or finishing mills, and the cloth went from place to place. Whether this was a contributing factor, I don't really know, but certainly in the north there were economies of scale, and they also had coal, which when the steam engines came in, the north was at an advantage. The mill owners, they paid for the railway line to come through to Nailsworth, really just so that they could get the coal from South Wales and the Forest of Dean coal fields. So they were slightly disadvantaged there. I just find that these kind of remnants of history are absolutely wonderful. I mean, I've always been very keen on history, but seeing it such a physical presence in the landscape. But I'm also a costume designer, and so I have an interest from the actual cloth point of view.
I imagine that the clothes in the mid-1800s were completely different.
Well, yes. You had the rich and you had the poor people. And clothes were handed down, of course, much more than probably they are now. If you think about the cloth that was being produced in these mills, which was broad cloth, a thick, dense cloth, and you think of, you know, riding on the top of a stagecoach, you jolly well wanted a good cloak around you.
I'm Robin Mitchell. I'm a member of the Stroudwater Textile Trust, whose aim is to tell you why we all live in Stroud. We all live here because of the water power and the sheep, the Cotswold Lions. So textiles was the reason we live in the Five Valleys. It started with the weavers who wove cloth in the cottages, bringing their cloth down to the fulling mills. And in our heyday, there were over 150 fulling mills in the Stroud Valleys. It happened here because this is where we had the wool and the water power. Also, the Flemish weavers came to the Stroud Valleys, and so it was earlier than the textiles that we all know of, King Cotton in Lancashire and the woolen industry in Yorkshire. So we preceded all of that. Narrow valleys, fast running water. We needed the water anyway for dyeing the cloth, but we also needed it for the water power, and we had the sheep, which was important. This was the formative area, really.
Well, tell us a bit about yourself. Well, I mean, you've actually worked in this industry, which for most people now, I mean, it's history. It's not happening anymore.
Yeah, I'm a fifth generation textile maker. I'm a Yorkshireman. My family had a firm in Yorkshire. And I worked there for a short while and then decided to move around the country. And when recession was on in Yorkshire, I moved to the Cotswolds, down to Stroud. Worked in Yorkshire, but I've worked in England, Ireland, Scotland and Wales, making textiles and running businesses.
The textile industry, how did it fit into the wider sort of industrial revolution, things like that? Because I suppose we think of it as being around about the beginning of that, but it was going, wasn't it, back in medieval time?
It was, yes, yes. A very primitive form of industry. Going back, I mean, making textiles goes back to the Romans, the Egyptians, you know, we all rely on clothing. And so,
I mean, am I right in thinking that Stroud was part of the step up from this kind of medieval cottage industry to something much bigger?
Yes, it was, yeah. And it was Stroud where we started to get the factory system. But sadly, once we didn't rely on water anymore, once steam power was king, why be in the Stroud Valleys? You can be near the coal fields in bigger valleys, build bigger mills and get the economies of scale. And that's when, in the later 1800s, the Stroud Valleys started to die away and lost their business to the north. All the mills started basically as fulling mills, but eventually the clothiers, who were the men who started to organise the business, recognised that they could have the looms down in the factories rather than get the cloth from the cottages and bring it to the factories. Let's face it, when Joe's weaving his cloth and there's a fault in it, the clothier is going to reject that cloth, so the cloth will be bought down and then rejected. So when that was happening more regularly, there's an element thinking, why don't we actually do all this in our own site, in our own mill, so we can control it. And that's when we started to bring all the other processes, the opening of the wool, the spinning, the weaving, all together with the finishing.
But it all started with fulling. What is fulling?
Well, fulling is pounding the cloth to make it thicker. And we started to do that by foot, so rather like treading grapes. And then by the middle 1100s, there are records in Gloucestershire of fulling stocks. So they replaced the men stamping with their feet with pounding with hammers. And they pounded the cloth and did the same sort of thing, made it nice and thick, because we needed warm clothing, so we needed thicker cloth. And then, as you'll see in one of the later processes, we put a nice nap on it, or a pile, to keep us warm. What you need to understand is in Stroud we made what we call Stroud broadcloth. That's 10 foot wide. But we want the cloth to be 6 or 7 foot wide. So in pounding it, we shrink it in width, and that width goes into thickening it up. So we get a nice thick cloth. The texture's different, yes, because in the unfulled cloth, it's thin, floppy, we can see the weave. By the time we've fulled it, the weave has disappeared. The cloth has shrunk in, it's thicker, more rigid. That's what we call a fulled cloth.
It has to go through a sort of a mixture, doesn't it?
Yes, we have some warm water.
Right.
And we also use fuller's earth, which is a very useful compound, can be used for lots of different things. But we're using it as a filler for the cloth, also to help to take some of the wool grease out of the cloth.
What is fuller's earth?
It looks just like soil, but don't build your house on it, that's all. If it's at the top of the hill today, it might be halfway down in the next 10 years.
Now, I'm going to embarrass you now, because I looked at the little display by the pounding machine we've just heard there, and it actually stale urine was also used.
Oh, it was, yes, yes. It was quite a valuable commodity for the weaver. When he walked down from his cottage to the fulling mill, he's going to take his bucket with him. He could get a penny in the Middle Ages for his bucket, which is a lot of money.
Well, it's certainly more than nowadays, isn't it?
We can do a similar process without so much pounding and crashing of hammers with roller milling. And roller milling does the same thing. It compresses the material.
It's like a mangle.
It is like a mangle, yes. It's a bit more sophisticated than a mangle, but it's doing the same. When we're pounding the hammers, we're compressing and relaxing continuously the fibres over a long period of time. And the roller milling is doing the same in perhaps a more gentle way, but it still gets the same result.
What time, age, are we talking about when the first fulling mills were being built in Stroud then, actually mechanical ones, rather than being done by hand?
It depends what you call a mill. After 1150, we would have what they called mills, but obviously they were very small. They simply consisted of a building with a pair of hammers in. What we call a mill today has a whole range of machines. So like we've talked about the fulling stocks, or the roller milling, we'd also have our second process, teasel raising, and other processes. We might do everything, as they did here at Dunkirk, from the raw wool right to the finished product going out to the customer. Yep. Vertical integration.
Yes, yeah. And that's where you're controlling the whole process.
You're controlling everything then. So you, if it's wrong, we know who to blame.
But then also, of course, it means the people who work there aren't making so much of the wealth, whereas they used to be, as a cottage industry, have quite a lot of power.
Yeah, the weaver as a self-employed man was really controlling his own destiny. Once the clothiers come along, they can give the weaver a bigger customer base. So the clothiers might say to the weaver in his bad times when he hasn't got work, we can keep you in work because we deal with the Hudson Bay Company, we deal with the East India Company, your product can go anywhere in the world. But by the way, this is what we're going to pay you. So they start to go down the scale a bit. And in modern days, the weaver will just stand at the... He still has to learn the same things. He has to know how the product is made, and he has to control his looms so that he knows when things are going wrong. But basically, the loom is doing everything for him. He presses a button, and if nothing goes wrong, it'll weave all day until he stops it at the end of his shift.
This mill, Dunkirk Mill, when was it built?
In the 1700s, it started to be developed as it is now and gradually continued through into the 1800s till decline came in the late 1880s.
Why have we got chimneys? Because as I see here, it's this giant water wheel. It seems to be water-powered.
Well, yeah, but these mill owners are quite ambitious. They wanted to do everything. They wanted to build their mills. And as time went on, Dunkirk ended up with four water wheels. And when that wasn't sufficient power, it also had a steam engine. So obviously more and more machines were being put in, which required more and more power.
They talk about them as the dark satanic mills, don't they? But how many people did it employ?
Well, weaving would have been one person per loom to start with. As we got more sophisticated and looms were able to control themselves more or control the faults they might come across more, he would look after more. So weaving was a place where you had quite a bit of labour. Spinning less so. You could make a lot of yarn from one mule or spinning frame in the later years. Finishing doesn't employ a lot of people because everything from all of these machines ends up in one finishing line. So you could have had, at a guess, 200 or 300 people working here maybe.
It was like it was the mill was sucking out the self-employed people from the... it was one of the beginnings, really, of the production line industrial process.
Start of the factory system, which is what we have today, where we do everything under one roof. That started in the textile industry, which was one of the formative industries of the Industrial Revolution, but obviously existed in other types of operation as well.
And what is Stroud's place today then in all this? Do we have any of these mills left in the area?
We do, yes. We have one. We have...
Out of how many? There must have been,
over 150, if we call them fulling mills, just little mills. But when I came to Stroud in the 1980s, we had three. Sadly, two of those have gone. And now we have one. It does make a very fine product, and one that you can often see on television, either at Wimbledon or the French Open or the American Open or at the World Snooker Championships. But you won't see it in the run-of-the-mill product because it is the top-class product.
And so where is that? It's a factory, isn't it, really?
It's a factory, yes. They do have their open days, but not quite like this, where we're open to the public throughout the summer.
So, we're at the stage where this industry really is almost dead now.
Do you know, all the time I've worked in textiles, people said the industry's dying, but it's still here, and what we do is we make the specialised stuff. We no longer make big volumes of the run-of-the-mill stuff. So if we talk about billiard cloth, if you go into a pub tonight and have a beer and then say to your mate, I'm going to have a game of pool, do you want a game? the cloth that's on that table will not have come from Stroud, because it'll be an ordinary run-of-the-mill cloth. And the same with lots of products in the textile industry. We are making specialised stuff. We no longer are the big employer we used to be, employing huge numbers of people, but we do still make a lot of textiles, mainly specialised.
Tell me about the organisation you're part of, the Trust.
The Textile Trust has been going for 15, 16, 17 years, something like that. It's telling the story of why we live here, hopefully educating school children up to pensioners about the industry that existed here, showing them machines from middle 1800s onwards, really.
And we're nestled under a whole massive development of luxury flats. The whole Dunkirk Mill is now pretty much luxury flats. How do you survive in this little corner here?
Well, actually, I think they quite like us here. They bring all their visitors who come to see them in their flats to see us here because they like it being here. And we have to thank the council for being forward enough looking to say, yes, we'll give you permission to convert that mill into flats, but you must have a visitor centre and you must make the water wheel work. Were you here today when the kids were here? When they see it start up, their faces just light up.
That was Robin Mitchell from the Stroudwater Textile Trust, and they're open generally on bank holidays over in Stroud.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now it's time to hear from Peter Berenius. His father was Tancred Berenius, who was the Finnish ambassador to Nazi Germany during World War II, was one of the people who persuaded Hitler's deputy Rudolf Hess to fly to Britain to so-called negotiate peace. But of course this was very convenient for Hitler's real deputy, Martin Bormann. All of the other people Hitler liked were being gotten out of the way.
I'm Peter Berenius, and we're at Cumbisset on the banks of the River Ebble. I remember some of these old Wiltshire characters that impressed me so much as a small boy. I was born in London, spent most of my life in towns, but every summer we came down here, and I was immensely impressed by the way the labourers used to talk about their experiences. I remember there was a man who did some gardening for my mother, and she complained to him, "You know, those blackbirds, they're doing an awful lot of harm. They're eating all our soft fruit up." And he replied, "Mum, in my opinion, it's two-legged birds that are taking them fruits." Of course, he meant thieves. So that was one of our favourite phrases. He was a great gossiper, that gardener, and I can still see him in my mind's eye leaning on his fork and saying, "Well, there's some people in the villages I shouldn't like to mention. For instance, there's old Mrs. So-and-so," and then up will come some scandalous piece of gossip. In fact, it always became a phrase in our family, "some people as I shouldn't like to mention." He always mentioned them immediately after he said he wouldn't like to mention them. The Ebble Valley is famous for being a place where one lady who wanted to be alone lived for considerable periods just after the war, and that was Greta Garbo, who lived somewhere up around Broadchalk, if I remember rightly. I must say I never met her because she was a lady who wanted to be alone, but it certainly must have suited anyone who was of a solitary disposition, particularly in those days. There was hardly anyone in the Ebble Valley apart from the local people. In the Wiltshire streams, most of the fish will take bread. As long as the pieces of bread are not too large, it will almost certainly bring trout up if there are any trout around. And most of the village boys know this perfectly well, actually, and get very unpopular with the fishermen as a result. Our feeding them is all right, but when you feed them with hook attached, it's a different story, isn't it?
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Tony, I come at this as a lifetime peace activist who has attended dozens of marches and protests in my own right. I consider that the freedom of speech and the First Amendment of the Constitution are the most precious rights of all. That is the right to dissent from government policy, the right to peaceful assembly, and the right to speak and in diversity of opinion and political viewpoints. I am frequently the one who is loud but not in the majority, and we are the ones who are always trying, I hope, to defend truth and to defend the accuracy of history. So I have a revulsion of any whitewashing of history. The official stories of history are frequently misleading, and history is written by the winner. That is often the mistake and the suffering of the loser. And I believe very strongly, I'm also anti-racist. I believe very strongly that black children are on the losing end of this argument, because it allows Democrats were the pro-slavery, pro-KKK, pro-Jim Crow laws, which restricted what blacks would be able to do in society. That was not Republicans who did that. That was the Democrats. And now Democrats want to revise the history books. They want to rewrite what they did, and they want to pretend that they were also opposed to all of these terrible things that happened to black people. And they were terrible. But the problem is that they were being done by the Democrats, and they were being opposed by the Republicans. And it is very dishonest, intellectually dishonest, to last night in I live in Maryland. Last night they pulled down all of the Confederate statues in the city of Baltimore. They were very proud that they pulled down the statue for Judge Taney, who wrote the Dred Scott decision. Dred Scott will now be forgotten. In my experience, as somebody who's lived in Maryland for almost 20 years, I came here from the West Coast, but I have now considered Maryland my home. And Baltimore is the capital of Maryland, is the big urban center of Maryland. And I can tell you that black children will no longer know who Dred Scott was, because the Democrats will erase it, because it's not pleasant to tell what we did. And the whole point of history, as you know, in Britain and in the UK, is not that things should be comfortable, but that history is antagonists and protagonists in conflict with each other, fighting in differences of political opinion, and then the outcome is what is carried through, you know, through the suffering and the sacrifice of many different individuals. And some of them are cowardly, some of them are courageous, some of them are weak, some of them have fatal mistakes and are fatally flawed, and that makes them human. And even our heroes make mistakes, and our heroes are human, like George Washington and Thomas Jefferson, who both owned slaves. And George Washington kept his slaves after the Revolutionary War because he was bankrupted by his fight. He was not paid during the Revolutionary War, so he went back to Mount Vernon and used his slaves to reestablish his family's wealth. It was a very selfish thing to do, but it was allowed by white society. Okay, so our hero has a flaw. All right, that's true, he does. But don't erase all of history because of this flaw. Understand the flaw. And Now, in what's happening in the state of Maryland is they don't want to talk about slavery. Maryland was a slave state. They pretend it wasn't. That, I think, is dishonest for black children. I don't think that black children benefit from thinking that this was that we were the good guys. We were not. We most certainly were not. The Civil War, right before the Civil War, Maryland had elected a states' rights legislature, but the governor was an abolitionist. So the governor refused to call the legislature, refused to swear them in and let them be seated, and therefore stopped a vote for secession. If Maryland had seceded from the Union, as they all wanted to do, the city of Washington, the District of Columbia, would have been surrounded on all sides by secessionist states. And the South would no longer have been contained by the Potomac River. They would have had 40% more horses, farm supplies, like food to feed their army. They could have made forays directly into Pennsylvania, but because of the refusal to let them vote in Maryland, they kept Maryland kind of on the edge.
But I'm
living on a plantation right now. House where I am at was a plantation, was the site of a major plantation.
Susan,
right north of Washington, D.C.
What's this all got to do with Charlottesville today, though?
Well, what it's got to do with Charlottesville today is that they're erasing history. And I'm glad you asked that, because what they're doing is they are erasing history. The Democrats are, in my opinion, eradicating what is not pleasant to tell and what is not pleasant to know. And that does not serve black people. The Charlottesville started off as a peaceful. The night before, there was a peaceful demonstration of individuals who opposed the eradication of history and the removal of the statues. That is wrong to say that they are white supremacists. They are not. Some of them, a few, may have been, but these were people who believe very strongly that the Civil War needs to be told accurately. The South lost the war. The battles are described in accurate detail of who fought what, when, and where, and how the day progressed. Nobody whitewashes that stuff. Everybody knows this is about slavery, and so it is actually a shaming of the South when the stories are told, because the South is then confronted with the truth of its actions. And this is, so reminding the South of its Civil War history, it's only the people who want to forget it are the ones who don't want to remember that it ever happened. And like in Maryland, okay, in Maryland, they have succeeded in eradicating the history, and people don't know what I've just told you. But in Virginia and all through the South, they are very fastidious about the accuracy of the details of what actually happened, and the battle structure, the battle lines, the military strategy that was used in all of the different battles. It's told with accuracy.
But isn't there a bigger thing going on here as well, Susan, in that there seems to be some sort of attempt to actually whip up some sort of, you know, racial divide or a ethnic divide?
Oh yes, there is, and it's Democrats who are faking a history. It is Democrats who are trying to erase what they actually did, and they're trying to say that the Republicans and the white people are the bad guys, and that is just not true. Antifa, that there was a peaceful nighttime procession with tiki torches, very beautiful actually, a march through Charlottesville to the square where the statue was. Hundreds of people came to it. Most of those people support adding statues that celebrate the slaves as well. So you would have Nat Turner, you'd have John Brown. These were rebels. These were slaves who revolted or who organized slave revolts. Frederick Douglass. Put the heroes in there. Harriet Tubman, don't erase the history. Put it in there so that we have a total picture. You know, most of us, that's what we believe, is that it needs to be inclusive and accurate. But what Antifa did, as soon as they knew this was happening, Antifa showed up the next day and came with sticks, balloons of urine, pepper spray. These were things that had to be carried in. There's pictures of black people, which is very bad, with flamethrowers, and they're actually trying to set people on fire. They're using aerosol cans as flamethrowers to try to set other protesters on fire.
There an element,
now,
do you
sir,
think,
this is,
Susan?
No, this is no mistaking it,
Susan.
Because these are Black Lives Matter people. These are Antifa people who have masks over their faces.
I mean, don't you think there's an element of this legitimate process being hijacked here by actually quite a small number of people, turning it into almost like political theatre for the world to watch and inflame tensions, because this isn't actually what it's about. It's about history, and it just seems it's being turned into something else.
Well, and here's something that we have just found out. The man who killed the woman with the car was an Occupy activist. He was his church. Everybody in the South goes to church. Okay, this is just part of life. And his church group has said that he was a leftist, big activist, a huge Obama supporter, and that he was connected to the Southern Poverty Law Center, and that he has a reputation for being, you know, pro Democracy Now, quoting Democracy Now a lot, Amy Goodman, and being a huge supporter of liberal causes. And now the left is starting to admit, now the corporate media will not admit this is true, but the blogs, the leftist blogs that have any honesty at all, are saying, you know, it looks like this guy was an agent provocateur. He wanted to incite a race war with the Democrats as the good guys, so he made a fake presentation, and now he's going to spend the rest of his life in jail. So he's going to have, you know, 20 years to think about what a brilliant idea that was, to kill somebody, to go out and slam somebody. But he was apparently a Democrat, an Obama supporter. So he's not a KKK guy. He's a big Obama supporter.
Okay, Susan. All right, that's brilliant. Thanks for filling us in on all that.
Okay, thanks.
Ta-da.
Ta-da.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm joined by Becky James now from Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting. Now, it's a bit of a mouthful and doesn't sound very nice, forced organ harvesting.
Yeah, it's horrible. It is literally what it says.
It sounds a bit Nazified. It's the sort of thing that, you know, you might get taken to a concentration camp, tied down, had one of your kidneys removed, that sort of thing, and then that could be then sold on the open market. Now, where is this going on?
Okay, so it's going on in China in state-run military hospitals across China.
So is that just for the military? So it's people who are in the Chinese military?
No, it started off in Xinjiang, which is northwest China, with the Uyghurs, where they were being killed for organs for Communist Party officials.
Who are these people? The Uyghurs?
The Uyghurs are a Turkic descent who live predominantly, well, they live in northwest China, in a big area that the Chinese have, you know, under Chinese communist rule, have taken over, and they call it Xinjiang now, which means new territory. And it started off in that area, but now more recently organs have been harvested from a spiritual group called Falun Gong. there's huge numbers of been disappearing and put in concentration camps and used as a vast pool of
organs. Well, it sounds horrendous. I mean, we're not hearing much about this on the news, are we?
No, I think the New York Times has written about it 7 times this year, so I think we've had a bit of a breakthrough with mainstream media, but I think there's a bit of apathy there because it's been going on so long.
Well, look, the problem with China is that you've got an attitude of we really like religion. The same sort of, I mean, I'm not talking about exactly the same kind of persecution, but I know, for example, they have a kind of official Christian church, and if you're not part of that, you cannot meet with other Christians. So what is it like in China if you don't actually fit in with the way they want you to in a sort of spiritual beliefs way?
It's exactly what you're describing. I think people are then seen as dissidents, you know, and you can be under threat.
But one thing to be a dissident, but another to be put in a concentration camp. I mean, what is the reality here?
Well, if I can go back a little bit, this, I'm talking about Falun Gong because that's my concern. I actually practice Falun Gong myself. And it's done a lot of good for me, a lot of benefit. And what we're talking about here are people being killed for beliefs. The beliefs of truthfulness, compassion, tolerance. And it was an ancient cultivation practice, which is basically where you're making yourself a better person in accordance to truthfulness, compassion, tolerance. And it was introduced to China in 1992. And within 6-7 years, it spread to between 70 and 100 million people. So the Chinese leader at the time, Jiang Zemin, felt that it was a threat. And we think it's because he became jealous because more people were doing that than
in his
communist
party. I'll tell you what's going on. This is my assessment, is that you had, with the communist revolution, you had a real downer on religion.
Yeah.
You know, religion is the opiate of the people and all this stuff. So they don't want any kind of religion at all. Mm. The people are left in a situation where they're actually open, much more open in a way, to new spiritual ideas.
Yeah. I mean, I think they're having a massive upsurge in Christianity at the minute. We don't know about the numbers of Falun Gong. Obviously, there's been, we believe, hundreds of thousands have been killed for their organs.
Tell us a bit more about Falun Gong then. You say you're part of this. I mean, how big is it worldwide?
Well, it's difficult to tell, but it's practiced in about 50 countries across the world. I mean, obviously, there were estimated between 70 and 100 million people practicing it in China up until 1999 when the crackdown began.
So Falun Gong really took off in China?
Yeah, I think it's because it works. It's good for you. We do exercises. We just try to live in accordance to universal principles. So it's about values, you know.
But it's not always easy, is it, to carry your moral ideas and your ethical beliefs into your work? Because quite often work is about taking money off people, conning them, you know. So how do you do, you know, this is, I suppose, another question really a bit deeper about how you can do that, you can practice your Falun Gong, but also earn a living.
I know, it is. I suppose, for me, I am not the best person to answer that question because my story is I had an accident on the motorway in 2005. My husband looked after me for 6 years. I used to be a teacher. I recovered practicing Falun Gong, and then since then we've got no children. We managed on one salary, so I got introduced to Falun Gong. I started to practice and I recovered really quickly. So I had first-hand account of it being really good for me. For people, I could understand how it had spread to so many people, but at the same time, I found out that they were being killed for their organs in China and I just took action. I thought, I can't not do anything about it. So I've not actually had to deal with what you're asking. I've just been able to be...
I just think it's a wider question about our society is that you know, there seems to be a kind of, you know, dog-eat-dog world out there, particularly in the world of austerity where the government is kind of not really looking after people the way it used to. And but anyway, look, what's the link?
They did a lot of studies in China, actually, when it first came out, to just, you know, show the good effect that it did have on society. I mean, it's not the aim of, you know, bringing this practice out, want to help society, but it had a knock-on effect of people were healthy, people were being kinder to each other. It really turned around a lot of
businesses.
So why
does the Chinese government not like it?
I know, it's like the million-dollar question. Jiang Zemin didn't like it and he just wanted to get rid of them. I mean, once you've got a huge bunch of people who are living truthfully and, you know, then, you know, I suppose they're quite happy to tell the truth.
Well,
if they're
not in awe of the government either, are they? But anyway, is there any links to the UK of this organ harvesting? Are there either people going to China to have new organs or else you know, even selling Chinese organs on the world market?
It's a really good question. In 2013, some of the people that I work with did a report under the Freedom of Information Act and approached lots of NHS hospitals across the UK. And, you know, quite a few came back and said they had had cases of people going to China for organ transplants, you know, becoming unwittingly involved in murder. But the thing is the hospitals here, nothing to do with it, but they have to provide anti-rejection drugs if people need it. And a lot of the people coming back were, you know, in really poor health as well, because the procedures weren't very good, or they ended up with hepatitis and, you know, they were really sick. So.
Well, yeah, but that's a big accusation murder, isn't it? Because sometimes these organs surely are taken from people who've died in accidents, that sort of thing, not necessarily murder.
Yeah. No, well, I mean, the donation system in China is really low. Amnesty International put some figures out about that a couple of years ago, so if anybody wants to look into that. Because what I do is encourage, if people want to know figures and facts, there's some really good websites with really good reports out there. And I'd encourage people to go have a really good look at it, because I was, you know, at first when I started to hear about this, I had lots of questions, I was a bit sceptical. And what I did is I did my own research. So I'm not here on anyone else's behalf, I'm just here on my own behalf, but I really wanted to know if this was true. So I read lots of things. So the latest, biggest report that's ever been done on this is by David Kilgore. David Matas. David Kilgore is the former Canadian Secretary of State. David Matas is a Canadian human rights lawyer, and they were approached to find out if these allegations were true, and they found no reason to say that they weren't true. And since then, they've, you know, that was in 2006, and they've gone on and done lots of other work into this. But with Ethan Gutman, who you did interview a couple of months ago with Alex, they've put together a report, the update, and there's lots of information in there. It's horrific. There's about nearly 700 pages with 2,000 footnotes.
But what about the actual statistics? How many people are having their organs forcibly harvested from them in China?
So Ethan stated in this seminar that his estimates with David Matas and David Kilgore had been too conservative when they were there in 2013. He spoke of tens of thousands, but actually now, since all the other evidence is emerging, and, you know, bear in mind a lot of this information has actually come off Chinese websites, from hospitals and from the Chinese Ministry of Health. Their estimates now are saying that the volume is between 60 and 100,000 a year.
So, okay, so is that 60 or 100,000 organs or 60,000 people being killed for their organs?
Transplants. Yes.
Yeah, that's really the number of transplants.
Yeah.
But do we know how many people are actually being killed? Because this is a pretty horrible accusation to make, so it'd be nice to get an idea of the scale of the problem.
It's really difficult. I mean, there's no evidence, because they're cleaning up, so it's really difficult. In the report, this huge report that we've got here, most of the evidence comes from these screenshots of actual Chinese hospitals, you know, like the third affiliated hospital of Sun Yat-sen University is in Guangzhou, our twin city.
So is that a military hospital?
Some of the military, they're all state-run hospitals. They're all state-run hospitals. Evidence, I mean, did the information coming out of China from people who've witnessed it, nurses who are working there, they've got nurses' journals, the Ministry of Health, hospital websites where you can actually find where the organs have come from, telephone conversations. There's no, for me now, it's gone beyond this fact of needing evidence. There's just so much evidence. It keeps continually pouring out. There's lots of websites. There's lots of people writing books about it. But for me now, we're at the stage where we actually have to try and address how we are going to combat it, because we've realised can we change what China's doing? We can only make sure people here are aware of it so they don't actually go and get involved in it. This is the stage that I'm at in Bristol.
So are people actually going to China for these to get organs?
Yeah, we interviewed somebody in Birmingham where he went for a kidney. And the difficult thing is, the problem is that people are not willing to talk about this once they've returned. You know what I mean? A lot of the people don't even realise that these organs are where they've come from. It's a really difficult area. I mean, somebody asked me a question a few weeks ago. They said, what are you going to do? What's in place for when this eventually comes out, which it will do, and it is, it's already out, what are we going to do about all these people who suddenly find out that they've had organs from people who are, they're not executed prisoners who've done bad things, the prisoners of conscience. What are we going to do about that when it all comes out? And I just thought, well, there's nothing in place for that. I mean, there's no guidebook with this. It's just, we're just having to deal with it as it comes up, which is why we set up Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting, because we just thought people need to know it's going on. We talk to people every day on the street, we're talking to people non-stop. We get lots of different responses. It's a really difficult area to be involved with. I'll get people.
What about numbers, though? How many people have had their organs harvested? Do you know?
Well, the estimates are between 60,000 to 100,000 a year. So this could be, what we know is one person used to be killed for a kidney, one person used to be killed for a liver, but now they're becoming a bit more clever in the way they're doing it. Now they're taking, maybe the infrastructure's so fantastic now that they're maybe taking, they're using bodies for multiple purposes. So it's really difficult to tell. Nobody's been able to get there in there and ask the questions. And the Chinese government are obviously not giving us answers about numbers because they're saying it's not happening.
Hmm. Well, that's what they seem to be saying. Anyway, how do people find you, Becky, online particularly? Is obviously going to be a useful place, because I imagine there are links there to some of the evidence you've been talking about.
Yeah, I'd direct people to the main website, which is endorganpillaging.org. And there's another website, which is Doctors Against Forced Organ Harvesting, DAFOH.org. Interestingly, they've just handed in 2.5 million signatures to the United Nations on over the last few years. They've been doing a huge petition. It's the second largest petition that's ever been done worldwide. And I do recall in 2013 they handed 1.5 million signatures in and didn't get a response from the United Nations. So it'd be good if we did get some response from them this time. And the website we've set up locally is Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting. So it's www.bafoh.co.uk.
Okay, so that's bafoh.co.uk. Yeah.
What we're hoping is anybody listening might want to just get in touch, because we've set up a local group to try and get more information out to people. We did screen a film in the council, which Alex and Ethan have already been on and talked about. There's also recently been some report come out, and part of it does come from this huge report, The Update, by Ethan Gutman, David Kilgore and David Matus. We're now aware of a really prominent UK architectural company that's just got a massive contract out to build a huge hospital complex in Dalian. And Dalian is the epicentre of the organ harvesting. It's the, the biggest, baddest, worst place. So I'd like, and if there are any architects who are out there who are listening who might be able to get in touch, because I don't like the reputation of UK architecture to be tarnished. It's really serious, we're talking about complicity. So there's lots of issues all linked to this. It's just knowing, not to give too, not to go off at a tangent, really. But.
Okay, so the website, I'll just say one more time, is BAFOH, Bristol Against Forced Organ Harvesting.co.uk. Becky James, thanks very much for joining
Thank
us.
Thank you.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. Download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Robin Mitchell from Stroudwater Textile Trust, Peter Berenius, recorded in 1992 down near Salisbury, Susan Lindauer, and also the local branch of Falun Gong. Also to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production catches on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Get hold of us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us, or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain, via the National Volunteering website, do-it.org. That was Dialect. Actually, signing off for a few weeks. We'll be back in a few weeks' time. We're having some very special programmes, that is, broadcast in the 1960s. Until then, when we're back, that is, in 3 or 4 weeks' time, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
Mm-hmm.